This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
This is Gary Clinton welcoming you to Night Transmissions, episode number 65. If there's any chance you're wondering exactly what Night Transmissions is, well, I'll tell you as briefly as I can. Night Transmissions is an audio show dedicated to the revival of old-time radio of the macabre. Well, it's not all macabre. Mostly it is, though. It's either macabre or mysterious in some sense. There's a good deal of science fiction, a good deal that isn't. A lot of it is just stuff that caught my attention in one way or another and I thought was interesting enough to pass along. You see, what I'm trying to do here is to be some sort of curator. I don't promise to be a good curator. I do promise to try to filter out the very worst. And by worst, I don't mean content or storyline. I just mean things that sound so bad that nobody should have to hear them. They click, they pop, they fade in and out. Voices become garbled. I'm going to try to avoid that as much as I can. Unlike some of these shows, I also promise that I will have actually listened to a show before I pass it on. And tonight we're starting out with an episode of Strange Wills, which hails back to 1949. And not a great deal is known about it. I mean, the production company is known. That was Telways. And the credits are there with each show. But it was produced for syndication. And the syndicators' records have disappeared. We have no idea how popular this show was, how broadly it was broadcast. It should have been. It was pretty well done. Even today, it holds up fairly well. The audio is a little bit crunchy. It crackles with an occasional pop here and there. But the articulation of the performers is good, and the whole thing is really pretty easily understandable. Tonight's story weaves the tale of a jealous older man and the avarice of a young, beautiful woman, and how that all comes to ruin in a crescendo not dissimilar to the final scene of the fall of the House of Usher. I rather enjoyed this one, which demonstrates how sometimes money can be a blessing and other times just a dirty trick.
Strange Will. Stories of strange wills made by strange people, starring the distinguished Hollywood actor Warren William, and featuring Loreen Tuttle and Howard Culver, with the original music of Del Castillo. I devise and bequeath to my heirs the seven deadly sins: pride, envy, hate, jealousy, anger, despair, and greed.
This is the story of a woman who voluntarily became a prisoner of love because of greed. It's not a nice story, quite the contrary. Mad Concerto is the story of a beautiful woman who gave up every feminine and human desire for the power that goes with dollars. 10 million of them. It happened a short while after I'd begun the practice of law in an eastern city on the Atlantic seaboard. I remember I was standing near the window of my office, looking out over the myriad of skyscrapers. Oh, how I craved excitement. How I prayed for one case to pull me away from the small, inconsequential work that is a young lawyer's lot. Perhaps I prayed too hard because... Mr. O'Connell speaking.
Mr. O'Connell, you don't know me personally, But many years ago, I retained your father as my lawyer. And I have every reason to believe that I will find you just as sincere and trustworthy.
Well, thank you, sir.
Don't thank me. I haven't done anything for you yet.
Yes, sir.
Have you a pencil handy?
Yes, sir. Mr...
Then take this address down. 127 Kingsbury Road. Have you got it?
Yes, sir, I have it. 127 Kingsbury Road.
I want you here at 10 o'clock tonight. Come prepared to draw up a last will and testament. My last will and testament. I expect you to live up to every vow of privacy between client and lawyer.
Oh, of course, sir. That goes without saying.
Good. My matter is urgent and, well, let's say, unusual. My name, Mr. O'Connell, is Walker. J.C. Walker. Good day, sir.
Had I heard correctly? Walker? J.C. Walker? No, it couldn't be true. Why, J.C. Walker was one of the richest financiers in America. Retired, he'd lived abroad and had recently come home. Why, my prayer was answered. I was excited. I tried to go back to the ordinary office routine, but the clock on the wall stood still. I'll never forget how long that day lasted. At exactly 7 o'clock, I got into my car and began the long 60-mile trip to the country estate of my client. I was tingling with anticipation.
You can't drive in there, mister. Private property.
I'm looking for 127 Kingsbury Road, Mr. Walker's residence.
What's your name?
O'Connell. John Francis O'Connell, attorney at law.
Oh, yes. Go right in. Mr. Walker is expecting you.
Thank you. I drove up the long driveway and stopped at the Walker Mansion entrance.
Come in, please, Mr. O'Connell. Mr. Walker is waiting for you. He's in his study on the second floor.
Thank you very much. As I entered the door, I stopped. It was like a beautiful dream come true. I mean her, of course. She was sitting at a concert grand piano, completely engrossed in her music. She was exquisite, something out of a picture book. She had a wild, barbarous look, and her blonde hair seemed to keep tempo with the strange, savage music she was playing. As I passed her, she glanced up for just a fleeting moment, and I saw she had brown eyes. Eyes that seemed to probe deeply into my soul. She held me with a long and tense look, and then I lowered my eyes and followed the servant up the stairs. Who was this strange creature? This most beautiful, most sensuous of women. Even the scent of her exotic perfume reached out like tentacles of doom and encircled me. Unfortunately, I was to learn later.
Congratulations, O'Connell. Sit down over here by my desk and go to work.
Thank you, sir. I feel very honored.
Don't be. You may yet rue the day I called you. Drink?
Yes, thank you.
Here's to a momentous night.
And to your health, Mr. Walker.
You gave me a hollow toast, Mr. O'Connell, because my doctor has given me just 2 weeks to settle my affairs and die.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not unhappy about it. I've made millions, had everything. It's time to let someone else have a chance. Now, here are the bequests I've made. They're all down here on a slip of paper. All but one. And that's what I want to talk to you about. Mr. O'Connell, you saw Nadia playing the piano as you entered, didn't you?
Oh, yes, sir, I did. I think she's very unusual. Very lovely. Very...
Mr. O'Connell, you're out here to draw a will.
Yes, sir.
O'Connell, I love Nadia. I love her because she is a genius. I recognized her unusual talent from the first day I met her in Vienna almost 9 years ago. I'd read that Nadia Winter was making her debut at the Wilhelmstrasse Theater, and I attended. Yes, and stayed to worship at the throne of genius. Never in my life had I seen such technique, such warmth and feeling. I remember as she was ending her final number. I left the theater before she had taken her final bow, and took the liberty of going backstage to make her acquaintance.
Yes?
My card, Miss Winter. I hope you'll pardon this intrusion, but as a sincere lover of music, I could not refrain from...
I'm very thankful for your interest, Mr. Walker. Won't you sit down, please?
Yes, thank you. I won't detain you for more than a moment. Perhaps you'll be made happy with what I have to tell you.
What?
It's simply this. I'm old, retired, rich, and frank.
And you might add interesting, too, Mr. Walker.
Be that as it may, I want to tell you that your work tonight has impressed me tremendously. So much so that I want to help finance the completion of your musical studies here in Europe. And later, I will arrange a series of concerts for you throughout the United States.
Oh, Mr. Walker.
Quite frankly, Miss Winter, I consider you a potential genius, and your talent belongs to all of us.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Walker. I am just a bit confused. All this is so unexpected. Of course, I realize only too well that a professional career in music is long, tedious, and quite expensive as well.
There need not be the slightest objection to my offer, Miss Winter. You may rest assured that your private life will remain your own.
I will consider your offer in the same frankness in which you have given it, Mr. Walker. Please let me think it over for a day or two. I'm staying at the Terror House. Well, call me later in the week, and you've been very, very kind.
As you can surmise, Nadia finally accepted my offer. I engaged the finest teachers for her, both here and abroad. Through the years, I think she grew to love me. Oh, not me personally, perhaps, but rather that innate sense of security that clings to wealth. Yes, Mr. O'Connell, this is a strange love that has borne strange fruit. I intend to perpetuate it. I want to die knowing that she will never love another man, that her every living breath will be devoted to her music and to my memory.
Forgive me, Mr. Walker. I wish to withdraw from the case. Some other attorney...
Nonsense, O'Connell. You're just infatuated with Nadja. All men are. It will pass. Nadja will see to that. Nadja has one weakness. She loves power, needs it in order to successfully concentrate on her career. I honestly think she would sell her soul for power in order to accomplish her goal. This is my only chance to hold her, and I'm going to do just that, even though it's from my grave. The last bequest in my will, Mr. O'Connell, is one to you for $10 million.
To me? $10 million?
$10 million to be held in trust by you for the use and benefit of Nadja Winter. She is to receive the entire income for the rest of her life, so long as she lives here in this house, alone, and never marries.
Mr. Walker, you can't be serious.
On the contrary, I was never more serious. This girl has one of two choices, to live in luxury the rest of her life, enough to satisfy her every whim and aspiration, or to fall in love and lose her genius. What she will ultimately do rests in the lap of the gods, and in the green-eyed monster of greed.
The will of James Carlson Walker was duly signed and executed 3 days later. And none too soon, for true to the doctor's prediction, J.C. Walker did not live beyond the following week. Nadja knew nothing of the trust, so I was instructed by the testator to advise her of the fact the day after the funeral. As I was admitted into the Walker residence, Nadja Winter was again at the piano, and her music more emotional, more savage than ever. She didn't hear me enter, and I stood quietly in the darkened shadows of the room. As the music swelled to a crescendo... I beg your pardon, Miss Winter. I am Mr. O'Connell, John Francis O'Connell, attorney at law. Mr. Walker asked me to come here and discuss certain business matters with you.
Oh, please sit down, Mr. O'Connell. And pardon me for not hearing you enter. I was lost in, shall we say, a musical plot.
Thank you, Miss Winter.
Please don't be so formal, Mr. O'Connell. Call me Marcia.
It would make me happy to.
Mr. Walker told me just before he died that you would come to see me.
Nadja, Mr. Walker has been exceedingly generous with you, in a queer sort of way.
I don't understand. He was always most kind and considerate.
I don't know if his bequest to you was either kind or considerate, but he was determined that it should be final and absolute.
He was always unusual, Mr. O'Connell. That is what made me love him. I never knew what to expect next.
Nadja, I am trustee over a fund of a considerable amount of money. $10 million, to be exact. You want to receive the entire income from this trust as long as you... Well...
Oh, come, John, it can't be as bad as that.
As long as you live in this house, alone, and never marry.
As long as I live here in this house, alone, and never marry.
Yes, Nadja. But if you prefer to leave or marry, the money is to go to certain charities.
I don't know what to say. What do? He has made me a prisoner. A prisoner of love. And $10 million to form the bars of my case. But I want money. I want power more than anything the world or life can offer. And $10 million will get it for me. I'll stay, Mr. O'Connell. Yes, yes, I'll stay. And I'll get everything I want from life. Everything.
You wait.
For the first few months, I saw Nadja regularly. She seemed gay and carefree, and her music was light and restful. Then, quite suddenly, I noticed a change. The transition was abrupt. There was a distinct violence in her mood, as if a storm was brewing. I decided to have a serious talk with her for more than 1 year.
Oh, John, I don't know what I'd have done without you these last 2 years.
But why must it be for only 2 years, Nadja?
Because that's the way I've taught myself to live. Never to look beyond the horizon. And especially where you're concerned, Mr. Counselor.
Nadja, I came over this afternoon to have a serious talk with you.
Well, darling, haven't you always found me to be a good listener?
Yes, that's the trouble. You listen very dutifully, and very beautifully, too. But somehow I never win my point before this lovely court of law.
You simply won't conform to my pattern of reasoning, will you, John?
No, because it's fallacious, Nadja. Now listen to me for a moment. For 2 years, you've been working over 8 hours a day on nothing but music. You've become a machine. Oh, why won't you...
Give up my inheritance and marry you? You've said it 1,000 times before, haven't you, John?
Yes, I've said it 1,000 times, but only because I love you, Nadja. I've loved you from the very first day I entered this house. I believe that your career is more important than a happy marriage, especially when you're forced to live alone. Alone like a prisoner in this house.
I do it from preference only, John. You see, I don't think you understand my temperament. I am an artist. My whole life has been devoted to one principle, to forswear the world for music. Don't think I'm the first to do this. Oh, all the famous composers have sacrificed in one way or another their devotion to create. I am no different. I eat, sleep, and love, to be sure. But never for a moment do I forget why I am here. My music will one day be my monument. Your love for me, my affection for you, must remain secondary and without hope of fulfillment.
But can't you see you've been changing, Nadja, and not for the better?
Oh, John, don't you realize the hopelessness of...
Oh, darling, you're young and beautiful. Your money's a curse that's not only permeated your body, but is affecting your soul. I beg you, let me turn it over to charity. Marry me now, Nadja, before it's too late. Keep your career. I'll do everything in my power to help you reach your goal. Oh, for the love I bear you, Nadja. Now, today, let's end this nightmare of horror.
Stop! I'll not listen to another word! John, I have never really loved a human being. I have not the kindred of them. I love only attributes in others. I love James Walker because he represents power, which to me is the greatest thing in life. And you too, John, I have loved for your kindness and your understanding. Sometimes I wish that... But it's useless to discuss it further. You are a lawyer retained by my benefactor to carry out the provisions of a trust. I cannot, I will not ask for counsel or advice. My life is mine to do with as I choose. Hereafter, you will mail my check, and I ask you not to come back until I send for you.
I see. I see I'm too late.
Goodbye, Mr. O'Connell.
Goodbye, Nadja. The savage way she turned to the piano horrified me. I left with a heavy heart. Yes, Nadja was losing her battle. Her power had been purchased at the price of freedom and sanity. I rode back to town, deeply depressed. I saw no more of Nadja for many years. 18, to be exact. Her check was mailed regularly, and I'd heard rumors to the effect that she'd entirely withdrawn into herself and permitted no one to enter her home. Even tradesmen were required to leave their wares on the steps. Then, early one winter morning, it must have been round 2 o'clock. Eh? Oh. Hello?
Mr. O'Connell. This is Nadja. Nadja Winter. Do you remember me?
Oh, Nadja. You haven't once been out of my thoughts these many years.
Come out right away, Mr. O'Connell. I have something of the utmost importance to discuss with you, and I want you to come alone. And please hurry. Please hurry, Mr. O'Connell.
I'll be out there as fast as my car can get me there. In 20 minutes, I'd left the city behind me and was making 60 over ice and snow that begged for caution. In memory, I was reliving the years.
The last time I'd seen Nadja, she was young and breathtaking. Greed had been her bedfellow, and power her counselor. I wanted to see Nadja again more than anything on earth. I left my car at the gate and trudged through the snowdrifts to the house. As I approached the once beautiful and ornate mansion, I could hardly believe my eyes. The front porch had crumbled. Even the steps had rotted away, leaving gaping holes in the foundation. The windows were broken, and the holes stuffed with paper. I climbed up and pushed against the door. It responded grudgingly to my touch. Nadja was at the piano, just where she'd been the last time I'd seen her. An old frayed dressing gown partially covered her gaunt, thin body. Her blonde hair, now streaked with silver, ran riot over her shoulders, looking like a thousand coiled serpents. Suddenly, she turned and looked up at me, and then I saw her eyes. Their soft brown luminousness had turned to stark, cold madness. She held me in her stare much like a cobra holds its prey. The blood left my face. I was terrified by what I saw.
Sit down, Mr. O'Connell. Things have changed a bit since you were here last.
Nadja, I'll call a doctor. You need help. Medical and spiritual help.
No, Mr. O'Connell, I don't need help. I've sent for you for a very special need. As you know, years ago I gave up the world and its pleasures. For money. And for power. I wanted money because it gave me a chance to create. I wanted power because it would make the world listen to my music. All these years I've created. My music lies here in these boxes. It will live after me because you are going to publish. Tonight I'm giving my last concert. It is my greatest creation of all. I call it Concerto Finale. You, Mr. O'Connell, shall be the first to hear.
The music started out softly, tenderly. It sounded like the sparkling water of a murmuring brook as it danced lightly along on its way through forest and glen. I imagined it to be the early childhood life of Nadja, when youth was gay and filled with the laughter of crowded childhood. I noticed a perceptible change. There were flashes of uncontrolled emotion breaking through to disrupt the calm tranquility of the theme. The tempo increased. The chords became discordant. It sounded like the cry of a distressed soul crying out for deliverance. Nadja was looking straight ahead, looking into the darkness and the gloomy shadows of the room. But I knew she was looking far beyond. She was reliving her life. And the poignant sorrows interspersed with happier moments had all been interwoven into this, the bitter end of her musical career. And now she'd entered into the final tragedy of her life. The wild notes shrieked into the room and blended with the moaning of the winter wind. I shuddered. Never had I heard music played like this before. To me, it seemed as if all the diabolical imps from Hades were striking the keys through her fingers. It was the discordant lamentation of the damned. I wiped the perspiration from my forehead in spite of the cold within the room. I must help Nadja and save her music at any cost. Quickly, I formulated the plan. While Nadja was lost in her mad reverie, I'd slip out and phone for medical assistance. I hoped she'd keep playing until I could return. I arose quietly and slipped out of the door and ran down the long snow-covered path to my car. I could still hear Nadja's music as it swept along in its mad theme of abject misery and despair. Just as I was about to enter my car, I heard a dull rumble come from the direction of the house. I looked up. Great soaring fingers of flame were shooting heavenward. The house was on fire. Even as I hurried back, I knew I was too late. Like something out of Dante's Inferno, this house was becoming the funeral pyre of Nadja and her music. Through the crackling of the flames, I still heard the piano. Nadja was ending her mad concerto. Then, quite suddenly, the whole house collapsed like a tortured moon.
Thank you.
And so ended the mad concerto. The girl genius, the lust for power, and the green-eyed monster of greed. But the sin did not die with Nadja Winter. It lives on in the hearts of men and women, secret and unconquered. The records simply say fire of unknown origin. Was it accidental? Could it have been a human sacrifice at the pagan altar of greed? Who knows? For greed is the cause of endless suffering. What would have happened to Nadja Winter, I wonder, if she'd been able to live a normal, carefree life and still retain her genius? Perhaps the two are incompatible. I don't know. Do you?
Strange Wills is written by Ken Cripin and directed by Albert Ulrich. This is a Teleways feature produced in Hollywood.
Incredible, but true.
Try as they will, the men of science cannot quite strip death of the air of mystery which hovers over it. Especially is this true when they are considering a death which occurred under circumstances as strange as those that surrounded the passing of Nicolette Bourget.
Dr. Emile Berthollet was an elderly man. And doubtless he had stumbled on many a minor mystery in his 40 years of medical practice. But none to compare with the mystery that confronted him on that first day of August, 1869. The day when Madame Guibert knocked at his door.
Doctor, would you come over to the rooming house with me? I'm afraid something has happened to one of my boarders.
As Dr. Berthollet accompanied his neighbor down the street, she explained what had happened.
It's Mademoiselle Bourget, doctor. She's a young woman in 307. A very nice young woman. She's been with me almost 2 years. And every morning I wake her at 7:30 sharp. But this morning, doctor, this morning she didn't answer.
You're sure she spent the night in her room?
Oh, yes. I was still up when she came in.
You heard nothing during the night?
Not a sound. And if there had been one, I would have heard it. I'm a very light sleeper.
This young woman is in good health?
The very best of health.
When they had climbed to the third floor of the rooming house, he too knocked on the door of room 307.
Mademoiselle! Mademoiselle Bourget! Wake up, mademoiselle! The door's locked and bolted on the inside.
Yes, so she must be in there.
Dr. Berthollet leaned his full weight against the door and shoved sharply with his shoulder. The lock yielded and the door flew open.
Doctor! She is not here.
Apparently not.
But I don't understand. The door was locked from the inside. Look, so are all the windows.
There's something else I don't understand. Don't you smell it? Stale smoke.
Yes, yes, I do. As if something had been scorched. But what could it be? There is nothing burnt in here.
No. Wait a minute.
Dr. Berthollet's eyes had fallen on the closet door. He strode quickly over, looked behind it, and then he staggered back with a gasp of horror.
Mon Dieu!
Doctor, what is it?
Stay back, madame. She's not a pleasant sight.
You mean, mademoiselle?
Yes. Her body's been almost consumed by fire.
Yes, there in that room, behind locked windows and a bolted door, where the acrid smell of stale smoke gave the only hint of what had happened, where there was no trace of fire on any of the fixtures or the furnishings, there lay the body of Mademoiselle Bourget, burnt almost to ashes. Why had she uttered no cry? How could the flames that destroyed her have been confined to the single spot in which she died? Such questions as these remain unanswered. And her death is a mystery which continues to baffle science. A mystery incredible but true.
Well, this brings us to our first break. Hey, I'm sorry, but I gotta do it. Look, I'm just gonna play some music, okay? Up next is an episode from The Witch's Tale, which was a horror fantasy radio series, which aired from 1931 to 1938 on WOR with syndication by Mutual. Created, written, and directed by Alonzo Dean Cole, and hosted by old Nancy, the Witch of Salem. You'll hear more about her later. Old Nancy was originally played by stage actress Adeline Fitzalan, who managed, at the age of 79, to die in 1935. I suppose that it's possible that Cole learned a lesson from this, because when he replaced her with a 13-year-old girl, Miriam Wolfe, who, with the able assistance of Martha Wentworth, who would occasionally play old Nancy. I don't know exactly what was going on there. I guess it could be that Wentworth came in when Miriam Wolfe had a test the next day in school. The show we have tonight stars Adeline Fitzalan as Nancy. Oh, by the way, Salem the Cat was often played by Cole, which may or may not have been the case for tonight's episode, The Devil Doctor, which aired on January the 8th of 1932. The story opens up, as again you'll soon find out, when an American couple buy an old English home complete with sullen, resentful, and unhelpful neighbors, strange noises in the night, and at least one too many undead residents. I like this one. I hope you will, too.
The Witch's Tale. The fascination of the eerie. Weird, blood-chilling tales told by old Nancy, the Witch of Salem, and Satan, her wise black cat. They're waiting. Waiting for you, now.
I'm earned sweet 16-year-old, I be today. Yes, sir, I'm earned sweet 16-year-old. I'm Satan. Now that me and you have had our customary sweet evening walk through the sweet, cheerful graveyard, we're all set to tell folks our customary sweet bedtime story. Now, tell these folks to douse their lights and we'll get right down to business. That's it. Make it nice and dark. And draw up to the fire and gaze into the embers. Gaze into them deep, and soon you'll see inside a big old handsome house in little old Merry England. And there begins our story, which we call The Devil Doctor. The Devil Doctor!
Dad? Oh, Dad?
Yes?
Will you and Stanley come in? Mr. Roberts is here.
Be with you in a minute.
It was awfully good of you to come over, Mr. Roberts.
Not at all, Miss Duffus. Before I received your father's message asking me to call, I had already determined to drop in and bid you welcome to Hartley Manor.
It's a very trivial matter that Dad wishes to see you about. Won't you sit down?
Thank you. I suppose you're very happy to be finally in your new home.
I'm sure we will be, but we've scarcely had time to become acquainted with it yet.
I see the decorators have made quite a few changes.
Yes, Dad bought this delightful place because it was so old and rich in tradition, then immediately decided to modernize it. I'm sure you don't approve.
I must confess to a slight dismay.
That will be the reaction of our other neighbors, I imagine. They undoubtedly consider it bad enough that Americans are to live in this historic landmark. I hope the liberties Dad is taking with it don't add to their resentment.
I'd like to be around when they resent it.
Dad, I didn't hear you and Stanley come in. This is the Reverend Mr. Roberts.
Hiya, Mr. Roberts. Glad you come over.
Thank you, Mr. Duffus.
You know, this girl of mine egged me into buying this place. Yet ever since I planked down a cool $500,000 for it, she's been kicking about the improvements I've made.
If you wouldn't try to change things too much, Dad.
Change is what makes the world go round. Excuse me. You haven't met my future son-in-law, Stanley Davis. Stan, this is Mr. Roberts, head man of the local church.
How do you do?
Sit down, everybody. Sit down. Now, before wasting any time in small talk, Roberts, I'm going to tell you why I sent you that message to come over here.
Good.
When I pay for anything, I expect my money's worth. And I paid for something in this house that isn't here.
The
solicitors told Dad that, as you are extremely familiar with the history of this house, you might help him in his search.
Search for what?
An ancestor.
An ancestor?
Yeah, I've been cheated. I was told that in the art gallery, there were 106 life-size oil paintings of the de Casserac family whose estate this used to be. But there's only 105, which makes one ancestor missing.
I see. The 106 portrait isn't really missing, Mr. Duffus. It is hidden behind a secret panel in this room.
A secret panel?
What's the idea of hiding my picture there?
It was hidden over 300 years ago, Mr. Duffus, just after its subject died.
Why?
Because Bertrand de Casserac, whose likeness it is, had placed a hideous blot upon his noble family name. He was one of the most infamous monsters who ever lived.
What did he do?
Allow me to show you his hidden portrait first. It will make the story more believable. The country people hereabout call him the Devil Doctor.
The Devil Doctor?
Yes. Let me see. The spring is hidden somewhere in this beaded molding at the side. Ah, I found it.
Oh, good Lord.
I'll be... 106 portrait is rather startling, isn't it?
For an instant it seemed that he'd walk right out of the canvas.
Darned if I didn't have the same feeling.
I'm glad he's only painted there. I've never seen such an evil face.
All except the eyes. They're expressionless and dead as those of a fish.
Yes, but that only adds to his frightful ugliness. Please close the panel again, Mr. Roberts.
Well, I don't know anything about art, but whoever painted that knew his business.
It is generally believed in this neighborhood that the artist was Lucifer himself.
You mean the devil?
That's a new one.
According to tradition, that is not a mere portrait, but a second body that Bertrand de Casserac will return to and wear someday, if he's able.
A second body?
Well, the evil Bertrand de Casserac was an alchemist, a delver in black magic, and above all, a Satanist.
You mean that...
Instead of God, he worshipped the Prince of Darkness. And in a certain vault below this house was often celebrated that most infamous of ceremonies, the Black Mass.
I've heard of it.
And so have I. It's a horrible perversion of the true Mass and is offered in honor of the devil.
Say, are you kidding me?
Unfortunately, Mr. Duffus, we are stating an awful truth. Bertram was finally accused of witchcraft and arrested. In the vault I have alluded to, an unholy altar was found, and hideous parodies of sacred images and vessels. And in the pit beneath the stone floor were discovered the bones of nearly 100 human beings.
Oh, he was executed, of course.
No, he cheated the local punishment by committing suicide. Then, according to the story, the people who so long had feared him rose in arms and demanded his body. They wished to burn it, fire being considered the only way to completely destroy an evil spirit. His relatives smuggled his remains from prison and buried them here. A bishop of the church attended and sealed each corner of his tomb with a holy cross.
Well, if that isn't the craziest thing I've ever heard of.
It happened 300 years ago, Mr. Duffus, in a very superstitious age.
Say, where is that vault where the old boy did his dirty work?
Below the east turret.
East? That direction?
Yes. Bertram's heir had the chamber bricked up, and so it has remained to this day.
Till yesterday, you mean?
I beg your pardon.
Well, I told you I was going to change things here. I went down in the cellars yesterday, saw that bricked-up doorway, and had the decorator's men tear it out and use the room to store their packing cases.
That vault is open.
I just told you the decorator's men opened it.
They are from London, and I'm familiar with the story, Mr. Duffus. If this became known around here, half this countryside would be thrown into a panic.
You mean that...
I mean the legend of the devil doctors and living truth to the people of this region. I beg you have that door resealed at once.
But why?
I have told you their belief about that portrait.
Why, you mean that old Bertram will return to life?
If he's able. And you have rendered his spirit a service by unbarring the way to his tomb.
His tomb?
Yes. For below the vault where he buried his victims, Bertram himself was buried.
His body is in that room?
Embedded in solid masonry.
By golly, it's beneath the center of the floor. I remember seeing four metal crosses on the corners of a big slab and wondering what they meant.
Oh, I want to see it.
So do I.
Now that I know what it all means, I'd like another look myself. Come on, Robert.
Yes, I would like to see it too.
Yeah, the stairs are right down this hall.
You don't have to tell Mr. Roberts, Dad. He knows his house better than any of us.
I'm afraid I do. And that is the reason, Mr. Duffus, I request you to seal that vault again.
Say, if you weren't a preacher, I'd say you took this stuff about the devil doctor pretty seriously.
As a preacher, I accept the Bible as the word of God. And Holy Writ bears many testimonies that evil powers exist which are dangerous to men.
Yeah, well, here's the cellar door. Say, help Edith down these steps, Stanley. They're pretty steep and carpeted with dust.
You see how useless is any attempt to convince my father of anything, Mr. Roberts. You won't even believe the man I'm going to marry will assist me downstairs unless he's told.
Well, speaking of convincing me, no one will ever make me believe there's any truth in superstition. The vault's over this way.
I haven't been down here before.
Neither have I. And after hearing Mr. Roberts' story, I shan't make a habit of it.
Mr. Roberts, since it's believed that that portrait of the devil doctor is a creation of infernal magic... Why was it never destroyed?
Because there's a further tradition that whoever harms it will be destroyed themselves.
Rot. There's the vault just ahead.
Your men didn't break the door.
It wasn't necessary. When they tore out the bricks that covered it, the door was standing open.
Open?
Yeah.
Strange. In the ancient record, it said the door was closed and locked.
Well, mind these packing cases as you come in. You're liable to snag your clothes on a bent nail.
And the shavings are strewn everywhere.
Yeah, I saw the crosses about there where that big crate is standing now. Here, give me a hand with it, Stan. We'll push it out of the way.
Yes, sir.
Ready?
Yeah. Let's go. Come on, push it. This box was weighed down here. Edith's concert grand piano was crated in it. This would be the case we'd have to move.
I see a metal crucifix.
Yes, connecting slab and floor.
Where are the others?
One should be right here if they were placed at all four corners.
But there isn't one there.
There's none in these far edges either.
They were there yesterday.
Dad, you and Stan tore them away with that heavy case.
Doggone, I guess you're right. Mr. Roberts, if the old devil doctor's half the man you say, he ought to jump right up and dance now with only one cross to hold him down.
Edith!
What's the matter?
The slab just... moved.
Moved?
I felt it under my hand.
Ah, quit your kidding.
I'm not,
Mr. Duffus. Feel the edges of this slab.
Yeah, what about them?
Lord, I see what you mean.
Dad, they're an inch above this floor.
You're crazy. They're absolutely level with it.
Feel here, Mr. Duffus. Now your hand is placed beside the one remaining cross.
No, that's funny.
Yes, it is.
None of you are chump enough to think this slab has risen since we pulled those other crosses off.
I felt it move.
Imagination. It's probably always been like this.
It couldn't have been, sir. If it hadn't been raised like this before, its sharp edge would have caught the cleats in that piano case. We couldn't have pushed it a foot.
Mr. Duffus, you may think me a credulous old fool, but I beg you have those crosses found and replaced immediately. Then have this vault resealed.
I'll do nothing of the kind.
Dad, for once in your life, give in to someone else. When we entered this vault, I thought the story of the devil doctor as fantastic as you still do. But since you moved that case, there's something awful here that's making me afraid.
I'm not ashamed to admit that I feel the same way. It's as though we four weren't alone in this vault. As though something repulsive and deadly is in here with us.
There is an unseen presence here. Can't you sense it, Mr. Duffus?
No. When I prove all this is bunk, you won't sense it either. You'll wait till I find a tool of some kind. This loose board will do.
What's he going to do with that board?
He bring you to your senses and smash a crazy legend.
He means to break that single cross.
Dad!
Don't! Stop him!
I thought a good sound whack would do it.
You've broken the crucifix.
The tomb is no longer sealed.
And not a thing has happened. You thought that slab would fly up and hit the ceiling, I suppose, and the old gentleman below would appear in a burst of flame. I told you I'd bring change around here. Oh, by the way, you'll have to change a good story now. Your crucifix is broken and not a thing has happened.
What's that?
What?
Someone's laughing.
In this vault?
No, it comes from underneath. That slab, one side slowly rising.
Good Lord.
Something is pushing it upward.
A skeleton wrapped in crumbling shroud.
It's rising from that tomb.
Run, Edith, run.
Yes.
To the stairs, the stairs.
God, forgive me, what have I done? What have I done?
Edith, darling, you must pull yourself together. We're safe now, safe.
Yes, that cellar door is locked and barred, and we're double locked inside this room. If we did see a thing that all common sense denies, it can't get at us here.
If we saw it, do you doubt the evidence our eyes?
And do you think locked doors will prevent that frightful thing from going where it wishes? That hideous nightmare you delivered from its tomb?
That's just what it was, a nightmare. It couldn't have been real, it's too impossible.
So one might say who for the first time saw a boa constrictor.
That's a natural thing.
Whatever is natural. We know this thing exists.
I can still see the awful horror of its fleshless bones, its crumbling shroud.
Edith, darling.
I still hear its frightful laughter, smell its sickening odor of decay and mold and death.
Edith, you got to snap out of this.
If you would only let us leave this house as the servants did when we ran screaming from that cellar. If only you hadn't insisted that we remain here.
I didn't ask any of you to stay here. I said I wouldn't run away like a panic-stricken fool.
You knew we wouldn't go and leave you here alone. And now night has come. And darkness.
Listen here. We've got to look at this thing like sensible human beings instead of superstitious children.
So you said when you broke the crucifix upon that tomb.
And I still think I was right. Why, I don't deny I've been as scared as the rest of you. Cold shivers are still running up and down my spine. But I didn't travel the distance I've reached in life by being a credulous fool.
You can't deny the evidence of all our senses.
No, but I can find an explanation of the way that they were tricked.
What do you mean, sir?
When I overheard Edith telling you this afternoon that folks around here resented our living in this old house, I think she called the turn on everything that happened. We're not wanted here, and someone conceived the bright idea of scaring us away.
Mr. Duffer!
And you, Roberts, were a party to the plan.
I, sir?
Father!
He came here with his talk of the devil doctor, didn't he? He showed us that picture, told us about the vault, and got us so steamed up we went down to see that tomb.
You seriously believe that?
Yes.
Mr. Roberts is a clergyman.
Which makes his skullduggery 10 times worse.
By Jove, I believe you're right, sir.
Stand!
Mr. David!
That explains the thing on natural grounds.
You think?
I think the ghost we saw was just a man.
You're mad.
No. That vault was dark. We could see objects and nothing more. A man was concealed in that tomb. It was his laughter we heard. Human laughter. The slab was so prepared he could lift it from below. Then, dressed in one of those skeleton suits, he appeared to scare the living daylights out of us.
You forget it was you who opened the vault. You who broke the seals upon that tomb.
Details. If I hadn't played into your hands, you'd have found another way.
Miss Duffus, you do.
Yes, I agree with Dan Stanley, Mr. Roberts. How could you do such an awful thing to us?
On my solemn word of honor, I swear you're mistaken.
You've done enough. Don't make it worse with lies. Your plan has failed, Mr. Parson. Go and tell the others who don't want John Duffus for a neighbor that he don't scare.
Stanley! Dad!
That laugh we heard downstairs.
And now it's in the hall, outside this room.
Yeah, the laugher doesn't know his little farce has been played out, but he soon will know.
Don't open that door!
Come on, Stan. Let's find this laughing skeleton.
Don't go out there.
Stan, turn on these hall lights so he don't slip by us in the dark.
Got him? Gentlemen, I beg.
You shut up. Stan, which way do you think that laughter went?
That way, toward the drawing room.
Come on.
Dad, Stanley, wait.
Huh?
Look, that cellar door. It's still locked and bolted as we left it.
Well, our laughing skeleton came up some other way.
There is no other way out of these cellars, and you can see no normal creature has entered through that door.
Yet we heard his laugh. From where we're standing now.
Oh, that doesn't mean a thing. Come on.
Wait, sir. Perhaps my imagination's playing me tricks, but there's a peculiar odor in this hall.
I smell it, too. It's an odor of decay and mold and...
And death. By everything that's holy, I beg you, leave this house.
Dad, look there.
Lord, upon this floor,
a trail of mold.
Oh, that piece of cloth.
It's a fragment of the shroud that figure wore.
Look, as I touch it, it crumbles into dust.
It's all a trick, but tricks don't fool me any longer.
That lamp again.
It is in the drawing room.
Where the devil doctor's portrait hangs.
What do you mean?
I've told you the legend of that picture.
The lamp has changed. It's become stronger. Almost human.
It's altogether human. Human enough to be punched in the jaw, and that's what it's going to get.
Mr. Duffus, wait.
After him. Don't let him go into that room alone.
He's playing with fire. Fire that will consume us all.
He's disappeared through that dark doorway. Quick.
Mr. Duffus, where are you?
By the window. He's not going to slide by me. You stay at the door, Stan, and turn on the light so we can see.
I've got him.
Well, there's no one in the room.
Oh, that panel.
It's open. As I feared.
Yeah, but the portrait's there, thank heaven.
Well, did you expect to find it gone?
It's changed. Those eyes we thought so dead this afternoon now shine with light.
They look alive.
Oh, another trick.
No, Lord, help us. The devil doctor lives again.
The laughter is coming from that picture.
The portrait's stepping from its frame.
The lights. Who put out those lights?
Lights. For heaven's sake.
Edith, where are you? I can't see a thing in this darkness.
Edith.
He's got me. Help!
Edith, he's taking her away.
Where? I can't see her.
Then that's going towards the cellar door.
That leads to the vault, to the room of the devil's mask.
Which way is it, Stan? Oh, God, where is that vault?
I'm as completely lost as you are. Oh, Roberts was right. We should have waited for a lantern before coming down to the cellar.
That would have taken time.
And that devil has my Edith. Oh, God, forgive me.
Davis! Mr. Douglas!
Roberts, he's brought a lantern.
Over to him, quick.
Yeah, we're coming, Roberts.
You still think he tricked us?
Not anymore. No trick could have brought that picture from its frame, and we saw it happen. Roberts, quick, lead us to that vault.
It's at the far end. This old-fashioned lantern doesn't give much light, but it was all that I could find.
It's enough. Hurry.
You've heard nothing further since you came down here?
No, the laughter stopped, and so have Edith's cries.
She's fainted, I suppose.
My daughter. Oh, God, forgive me.
There's the vault.
The door's closed.
I'll soon...
Oh, it's barred inside. Help me, Stan.
I'm with you.
That door is solid oak and sheathed with iron. You'll never break it that way.
No, it doesn't even budge. What are we going to do?
That heavy beam lying over there.
We'll use it as a battering ram.
Wait. Listen.
Voice inside. Chanting something. In Latin.
Yes. The black mass.
The black mass?
In honor of Lucifer. The devil doctor is about to offer up a sacrifice.
Edith! My girl!
You've got to break in that door, quick!
Yeah, got to! Stand, that ram!
With everything we've got!
Oh, it doesn't even give!
Again!
Oh, what's that devil saying?
His monstrous ritual nears the time of offering.
For the ram! The ram! The door won't give!
When it does, how are we going to stop that thing inside? A thing that's neither the living or for the dead.
In faith there is a way. Break down that door. Father, help me to be strong. Give thy servant faith and help him banish fear.
But it is that time. But the voice inside's mounting.
Yes, it's awful prayer to evil. Break that door, we shall be too late. Father, give thy servant faith. Help him banish fear.
We've got to break it down.
It gave in. It splintered.
Again, with all you've got.
We've crashed it.
Come on, Edith.
Help. Oh, help.
She's lying on that slab.
A living altar.
The devil holds a knife above her breast.
I'll get him. You said you had a way to stop him.
By the power of the cross, the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, I bid you.
Oh, he only laughs.
He holds that knife above my daughter.
My fear is stronger than my faith. Oh, Father, help me.
Gloria in profundis, Satani, in profundis, Satani, Gloria.
He's going to strike.
No, not my child. No.
Oh, devil's covered a body with his own.
The knife is buried in his back.
The devil doctor, he's raising that knife again.
But the Father's love has shown my faith the way to banish fear. In the name of the one and only God, I bid you, whom men once called the Cassarac, return to the hell from which you came.
Mortis, he retreats.
In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Dad. Dan, he's covered with blood.
Get Edith from this vault, away from that fiend of hell.
Satan!
He can't hurt us now. He's backing towards his tomb.
Satan!
Where another fool like me can bring him back someday. I've heard that fire will destroy a thing like him forever. Give me that lantern, Roberts. Those shavings will burn.
They've caught fire.
Yes, between that devil and the only door. And he's not laughing now. He knows there's no escape.
Run, all of you. In a moment, this place will be a furnace.
Yeah, run. Oh.
Ben, Dad's fallen.
Robert, here, help me lift him. Get him out of here. We all be burnt to cinders.
Yes.
Save my girl, Stanley. Get her out of this. Never mind me.
Sedaris! Sedaris! You have deserted me! Ah! The fire consumes me! Ah!
We are safe from the devil, Doctor. He is surrounded by fire.
Sedaris! Sedaris!
Not yet safe from the fire ourselves.
Oh, if we can only get Mr. Duffus to the door. Oh, help, Edith. Pull!
Oh, Sedaris! Sedaris! I die! I die!
It is the will of God that evil so perish. Let the fire consume him utterly, O Lord.
Oh, thank God, the door at last. Come on, Mr. Duffus, just a little effort. That's it.
Sedaris! Sedaris!
Shut that door, for God's sake. His cries curdle my blood.
Sedaris! Come to the aid of thy servant! Come! Aid me!
Thank God it is over.
Daddy... Daddy, you! How are you?
Oh, yes, I'm not a corpse yet. But then I was born lucky. Reckon my idea of changing things has worked after all.
Your craving for change awakened the almost unchangeable. But it has been the means of removing the baneful and evil spirit of hell which so long has menaced this house. Listen. It is over.
And so, Satan, we also bring our story to an end. Now we'll go find ourselves a nice graveyard and get inspiration for another pretty bedtime yarn to spin these folks next time.
Gosh, Mr. Smith, I can't keep the ladies away.
Well, I should hope not. Spring Glory is one of the loveliest patterns International Sterling has ever created.
Boy, do those gals love me. I bring out my velvet mat and put down a knife, fork, and spoon in the Spring Glory pattern. Then I point out the unusual features, like the openwork on the handle and the way it unfolds into one perfectly carved flower. Why, Mr. Smith, I have those women hanging on my every word.
Yes, especially when you mention the price, I imagine. For International Sterling, alone among leading silver people, has not raised prices since 1944.
Yeah, I guess what you mean, Mr. Smith, it isn't irresistible me. It's irresistible International Sterling that brings all those women into Mr. Jonathan's silverware store.
Well, all I know is that no woman can ever resist the solid silver with beauty that lives forever, and that's International Sterling.
The Hands by Richard Sternbach. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Hands by Richard Sternbach. The story of creation, in all its majesty, was written in 600 words. Will the destruction be told as briefly? He was a gigantic figure, sitting there atop the mountain. He could have leaned over and dammed the river below with a finger. He sat on top of the mountain, and his beard in the wind was a white flag. Across the plains, as he watched, there were fires glowing, and the mountain under him trembled from explosions 1,000 miles away. He bent his head, and a muffled cry reverberated down the hillside and through the valley. A smaller figure appeared beside him, looking sad. "Try again, Father," the smaller one said. The old one shook his head. It would be the same. "Give them another chance." They would do it again. "Just once more." The old one shook his head again, and for a while they sat, and they watched the destruction. The fires burned higher, and the explosions shook their mountain more roughly. At last, at the end, the Old One reached down and scooped up some clay from the bank of the river. He held it in a huge, gentle hand, and the younger one smiled. "You are good to give them another chance, Father." "Not them," said the Old One. "What do you mean?" the son asked, wonderingly. "Something else," the majestic figure answered, starting to knead the clay. "What shall it be?" End of The Hands by Richard Sternbach.
We got a break, but we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. During the 1950s and 60s, there were two satirists working in science fiction who achieved a stature denied to others. The first, if you've listened to this show much, then you know what name I'm going to say. Robert Sheckley. Robert Sheckley was one of my favorite authors, often with his satirical works making me smile or laugh out loud. The other fellow was a guy named William Penn, who is probably less well-known today. And if true, well, that's a shame. He was just wonderful, and many of his books are still available, still in print. Penn was born in 1920 in Great Britain. His family moved to the United States before his second birthday, and he was raised an American. You might consider William Penn to be a polymath. His interests were wide and varied. His first story, published by Astounding Science Fiction in May of 1946, dealt with the notion that it might be practical to aim a radar beam at the moon and thereby make some measurements of things that were not entirely clear at the time. Like the distance. You aim the beam at it, it bounces back. You can measure the distance to a precision that was then unknown. And sure enough, within a few months, the signal cords did exactly that. Penn himself didn't have a very high opinion of this, his first short story, having been known to say on more than one occasion that it was a bad story. But it did prompt him to work much harder on his next story, which would be successfully published in the May 1947 issue of what was then the prestige science fiction magazine, Astounding Stories. And then would be the basis for the Dimension X program that I'm about to play from Dimension X for June the 21st of 1951. We have their adaptation of William Penn's Child's Play.
Adventures in Time and Space. Transcribed in Future Tense. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of Astounding Science Fiction, bring you Dimension X. In these times, even a child knows the meaning of atomic fission, jet propulsion, and electronic transmission. What, we ask ourselves, will the child of the future know? What of the time when science unlocks the secret of life itself? Could it be that one day, such things as constructing human life or passing back and forth from one dimension to another will become mere child's play?
My name is Sam Weber. I'm an attorney, and a pretty successful one, if I do say so myself. My wife Tina and I live in a comfortable 12-room place up in Westchester. Now, I've read a lot of Horatio Alger stuff in my time, and so have you probably, but I'll bet you've never heard anything quite as spectacular as my story. Maybe you won't believe it, but I used to be a completely different guy. Frightened, sickly, nearsighted, a real Mortimer Meek. No kidding. That was 5 years ago. The big change in me began to take place on a cold December morning in 1945.
Just a moment, please. Yes, please.
Weber?
Yes.
Samuel?
That's right.
Step back. Okay, fellas, bring it in.
Oh, just a moment. You must have the wrong address.
Watch it, buddy. All right, sign here.
Is that for me?
Weber Garden Apartments.
Looks like a coffin.
I don't design them, Jack. I just deliver them. Sign here.
After much straining, I wasn't in very good physical shape those days, I managed to push the box under my single light bulb. There was a card in a small envelope.
Let's see. To Sam from your classmates at the Interdimensional and Cosmic Institute. Merry Christmas. 2145 A.D. Holy jumping catfish. Hey, mister, there must be some mistake. Hey! Holy jumping catfish.
They were gone, and I didn't even know which delivery company it was. Well, I finally decided to open it up and see what was in it. After about a half hour of fumbling, I gave up.
All right, then, don't open.
No sooner had I said the word open than it came apart like the skin off a banana. There inside was something resembling a kid's chemical set. Vials, jars, tubes, wires. You never saw so much scientific-looking junk in your life. And on top of it all was a book of instructions.
Build a man set number 3. This set is intended solely for uses of children between the ages of 11 and 13. The equipment will enable to build and assemble complete adult humans in perfect working order. A disassemblator is provided so the set may be used over again. Refills and additional parts may be acquired from the Build-A-Man Company, 928 Diagonal Level, Blunt City, Ohio. Remember, only with Build-A-Man can you build a man.
When I left for work that morning, my brain was still reeling with the stuff I'd read in the instruction book.
Jack, attorneys at law. Just a moment, I will connect you with Mr. O'Jack. Oh, good morning, Mr. Weber.
Good neuron. I mean, good morning. Gotta get my mind off that book.
Only with Build a Man can you build a man. Chapter 1, Making Simple Living Things. Chapter 2, Duplicating Babies and Other Small Humans.
Oh, no. I've got to get a grip on myself. Here, do a little work. O'Brien versus O'Brien. Martin versus the city of New York. Oh, it must have been a dream. Probably go home tonight and find the place empty.
Well, 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 if it isn't the poor man's Clarence Darrow.
Oh. Hello, Lou.
I come as a bearer of sad tidings.
Well, you don't look very sad.
The boss wants to see you, laughing boy.
What about?
How should I know? Oh, and by the way, you'll be very happy to know that I've just been promoted. I'm handling all the criminal stuff from now on.
Congratulations.
You know what this means for Tina and me, don't you, Junior? Oh, well, cheer up. Tina's not for you anyway. Some got it, some don't. I got it, you don't. So long, laughing boy.
That was my good friend, Lou White. In the year I'd known him, he'd already managed to steal a job I wanted, and he was now working on the girl I wanted. Her name was Tina. Tina Velvet.
Good morning, Sam.
Oh, good morning, Tina. My, you look good enough to...
Yes?
Take the lunch.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sam, but I promised Lou.
Oh, sure.
I hope you're not too disappointed.
Me? Oh, no. Some got it, some don't. I don't.
that with Tina. I tried to steady my blood pressure as I walked into the boss's office.
You sent for me, Mr. Rojak?
Oh, yes. Sit down, Weber. Sit down.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Rojak.
Weber, I've been reviewing the work of my staff counselors for the past 6 months. I want to know only one thing.
Yes, sir?
What happened?
I don't understand.
You haven't had a single new client in 6 months.
But no one has come in, Mr. Rojak.
My boy, in this business, you've got to be aggressive. You've got to go out and create new clients. You've got to show some zip.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any zip?
Oh, yes. Yes, Mr. Rojak. Oh, I've got zip, all right. I just can't seem to turn it loose, that's
well,
all.
Well, get in there and punch now, Weber. I want to see a change in you in the next few months. As a matter of fact, I'd better. You got that?
Yes, Mr. Rojak. I'll try to show some zip.
I left the office early and went home. Sure enough, there it was, my Bill the Man set, gleaming a little obscenely in the corner. I walked over to it, gave it a kick, and hollered,
"Open sesame."
3 minutes later, I was flopped down in bed reading
Chapter 1, Making Simple Living Things.
An hour later, I was fooling around with such complicated items as the Junior Biocalibrator, which measured everything from blood pressure to hemoglobin content, and the Jiffy Vitalizer, which was actually supposed to put life in your creation, providing you had followed instructions carefully. At 8:30, I made my first simple living thing.
Here, boy. Here, boy. Oh, maybe you aren't a boy. Well, let's see. According to the book, you are a rubicular oyster hog. Not much to look at, but I made you. Me, Sam Weber, attorney at law. I have created life. Hey, come back here. Come back. Here, boy. Here, boy. Hey, hey, hey.
It was no use. My rubicular oyster hog, which was a cross between a field mouse and an oyster, had run out under the door and into the world. I was about to take off after it when there was a knock on my door. It was Mrs. LaPanty, my landlady.
Oh, hello, Mrs. LaPanty.
I heard a noise.
Oh, just rehearsing a speech I have to make in court.
You must quicken.
The bad throat.
Oh. Oh, by the way, there was a gentleman looking for you this afternoon.
A gentleman?
Yeah, a tall old man in a black overcoat. Kind of nasty. Well, I told him he wasn't anyone to go up to your room. Tell you I showed him the way out in a hurry.
Oh, thanks, Mrs. LaPanty. Probably a bill collector.
Yeah. Well, I gotta run.
Oh, good morning, Sam. Here's that memo on Rosenthal versus Rosenthal and also a letter for...
What's the matter? You look tired.
Had a bad night.
Your lumbago again?
Yes.
Oh. Say, by the way, your client was here again this morning.
A client?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, it must be the same fella that called at my house the other day. Well, what did you tell him?
Oh, I said you'd be in later.
Oh, thanks.
Will that be all, Sam?
Yes. Oh, no. Are you doing anything New Year's Eve?
Oh, Sam, you haven't even noticed.
Noticed what?
Well, the ring, silly. Third finger, left hand.
What?
Oh, Lou gave it to me. Isn't it simply gigantic?
But you're not...
We're going to be married as soon as Lou finishes his next case. Lou is so sharp and businesslike.
So is a guillotine.
Sam, after Lou gave me the ring last night, I began thinking how I used to hope that it would be you. But, well, then I realized you'd never have the money and... Well, a girl has to think of things like a good, steady income and a husband with...
Zip.
Yes, with zip.
Well, Lou has plenty of zip. I'm sure you'll be very happy zipping around with each other.
Oh, Sam.
Well, Sam, I... Hey, what's going on in here? Honey, is that little baboon giving you any trouble? If he has, I'll take him apart like an egg crate.
No. Take it easy, Strongheart. Tina just told me the good news about your engagement. She's crying with happiness.
Is that right, honey?
Well, then no hard feelings, Sam. Just that the best man got the girl, you understand. Oh, say, by the way, we're having a little celebration at Sigali's tonight. Drop in and we'll live it up a little, huh?
I went home feeling like a man who has been stuffed into a washing machine with the dial set at rinse dry. I was a failure. I walked over to the mirror for a heart-to-heart talk with myself.
Nothing. That's what you've got, Sam Weber, in unlimited quantities. Nothing. We ought to just tear you down and start all over again. We ought to take you... Hey! Oh, no. No, not that again. But why not? Think of it. A Sam Weber without the psychological problems you've got. A dynamic, uninhibited Sam who could win a girl like Tina by sheer magnetism. Then when it was all over, we could just take the old disassembler and presto. And I can do it, too. Chromosome content. Check. Cerebral content. Maybe a little more it and a little less superego. Limbs, eyes, hair, general endocrine reaction. Well, here goes. It's moving. Holy mackerel, it's alive. It's getting up.
Say, I feel great.
Well, now, take it easy. Do you know who you are?
Of course I do. I have all the thoughts you ever had up until the point I was vitalized. My brain is an exact duplicate of yours, except that I'm not all blocked up psychologically.
Right. It said in the instruction manual you'd be uninhibited.
Say, this is all right. Oh, by the way, since we both have the same name, it'll simplify things. If I call you Weber, I'll be Sam.
Oh, now look here. I'll make the decision.
How would you like a good punch in the nose?
Well, is that any way to talk to your own parents? I did create you, you know.
Well, don't think I don't appreciate it, Weber, old man, but let's get one thing straight. I live my life and you live yours. You got that?
Who pays the rent?
You do, for a while anyway. I haven't decided whether or not I want to stay in the law business.
The law business?
I may want to spread out a little. Tina's the kind of girl to whom money is very important.
Tina?
Well, what did you expect? I have enough of your likes and dislikes to want her just as badly as you do. The only difference being that I can get her. Oh, we're not quite the same, you and I. I've got zip.
Don't use that word.
Now, how about some dinner? You know, I'm starved.
I'll have to go out.
I'll need some clothes.
Sorry, I only have this one suit.
Fine, you can lend it to me.
Well, what about me?
I'll bring you a sandwich after I come back from Sigali's.
Sigali's?
Well, you haven't forgotten, have you, Weber? We're invited to the celebration. Tina and Lou White. Only it wouldn't look quite right if we both showed up, so I'll tell you all about it. Now, off with that suit. And no nonsense.
Well, this is living it up, folks. Yahoo!
Have another drink, Mr. O'Jack.
Thank you, Lou.
Well, is everybody happy? Hey, honey, are you having yourself a little old time?
Oh, yes, Lou, fine.
Yeah, but you seem to be preoccupied.
Oh, I was just wondering if Sam is coming.
Sam? Oh, no. Did you hear that, Mr. O'Jack? She's worried about Sam. Why, that little runt probably got frightened by a noisemaker.
Well, the happy couple.
Sam!
Good evening, cats. Everybody's lit up like a Christmas tree.
Well, I'll be... Say, Sam, are you in the bag?
Never touch the stuff, Luma boy. Never touch it. Boy Scout training.
Oh, Sam, I was afraid you weren't coming.
Miss a chance to be with you, beautiful. Never.
Hey, what's got into you, Weber? Monkey glands?
I don't read you, muscle bound.
Well, you seem different somehow, even your voice.
Do you notice anything, Tina?
Well, yes, it does seem richer somehow.
Ah, nonsense. Sam Weber, you're nothing but a cream puff, and you always will be.
Mr. O'Jack, I think he owes me an apology for that.
I should think so.
All right, all-American boy, make with the apology.
Apologize me? Oh, no. Why, for 2 cents?
Folks, would you excuse Mr. White and me for a few minutes? We want to step out into the hall for a little private conference. Coming, Mr. White?
I'll be right back, honey. Don't worry about a thing.
Okay, big boy, You've taken enough punishment. Now.
Sam! Lou, don't kill him. He did... Oh, dear.
He'll be all right in a little while, baby.
But did you... I mean... Oh, Sam.
Tina.
We really shouldn't kiss like this.
It's what you've always wanted, isn't it? Well, isn't it?
Oh, Sam.
By this time, he's probably kissing her. And there's nothing you can do about it, Weber, old man. Nothing. Hey, wait a minute. Where's that book of instructions? To disassemble a Build-A-Man model, merely focus the ray of the disassembler device and press lever X. But that's murder, Counselor. Still, legally, in order to prove there's been a murder, you need a corpus delicti. And nobody even knows there is another Sam Weber. Oh, so you're finally home. I'm starved.
Sorry, Weber, old man, but very pressing business detained me.
I suppose you made a fool of me over at Sigali.
Oh, on the contrary.
What do you mean?
My boy, you were looking at a man who in one fell swoop has got himself a raise, a promotion, and a wife. At least she'll be my wife tomorrow.
Who?
Gina, of course.
I don't believe
it. I had to put on quite a show, but all around it was a real success. Mr. Ojak was so impressed, he called me aside and said he was going to give me a crack at some criminal cases. And if I made the grade, why, who knows, I may even accept a partnership.
You've got it all figured out, haven't you?
That's about it.
Only you neglected to consider one thing.
Oh, what's that?
This.
Hey, put that down.
Get back, you. You usurper, you. I'm going to melt you down like a Welsh rarebit.
Weber, you can't do that. It's murder. It's like killing your own son.
After what you've done to me, it's a pleasure.
I didn't ask to be brought into this world, but now that I'm here, I like it enough to want to survive.
Take off my suit, you phony. You won't be needing it again.
You're really going through with it, huh?
I am.
All right. Oh, here's your jacket.
My arm!
Give me that thing. Give it to me. That's better. Now we'll fix this little item so it can't do any damage.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you see, Weber? You don't have the guts to stand up against the man you might have been.
Oh, what's that sound?
I don't know.
Seems to be inside the house.
Somebody's coming up the stairs. Listen.
Take a peek through the keyhole, Weber. Yeah. Holy jump. It's him.
Who?
The old man with the black coat. His eyes all black and shiny without any whites. Looks insane. Don't open it. He's burning it. He's burning a hole right through the door.
Good evening, gentlemen. As I feared, I'm too late to prevent you from duplication, Mr. Weber. And I see that you have destroyed the disassembler. That means I shall have to do the job manually. An ugly task.
Well, who are you?
I am the census keeper for the 24th Oblong. You see, your Build-A-Man set was intended for one of the Weber children who is on a field trip in this Oblong 200 years from now. Because of an unfortunate time warp, the set was delivered here accidentally.
You mean this set came here from 200 years from now?
Precisely. Time, as with all things, is relative. We shall have to recover the set, of course, and adjust any discrepancies it has caused. But meanwhile, the problem is, which of you two gentlemen is the original Sam Weber?
Oh, I am. Listen, Meyer.
Difficulties. Why cannot I ever have a simple case like a double quadruplication?
Now, look here, Mr. Census Keeper. The duplicate will obviously be
less stable and more emotionally unbalanced. Certainly, a man of your qualifications can decide which of us is the more valid member of society. Which of us will conform more readily to the standards.
Naturally. I observe that one of you is naked.
Oh, wait a minute.
And you also seem to be trembling, whereas this gentleman seems quite calm.
No, hold it. You're making him say.
I hardly think so.
No, stay away
from me. Please do not struggle.
Help. Please, you...
Mr. Weber.
Yes?
It would be better if you didn't watch.
Of course.
Well, that's my story. Within 10 seconds, the old Sam Weber had been completely dismantled and packed into the box. Tina and I were married, and I went on to become a full partner in the firm of Ojak, Somerset, and Weber. Oh, and by the way, Tina and I have been doing quite successfully what the old Sam Weber and his Build a Man set made such a mess of. We have 1, 2, 3 little conuplications. Sam Jr., age 4, Sametta, age 3, and Samina, age 4 months. Good night.
You have just heard another adventure into the unknown world of the future. The world of... Dimension X is presented, transcribed each week by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of the magazine Astounding Science Fiction. Today, Dimension X is presented Child's Play, written for radio by George Lefferts from the story by William Ten. Featured in the cast were Leon Janney as Sam, Carl Weber as his alter ego, and Patsy Campbell as his girl. Your host was Norman Rose, music by Bert Berman. Dimension X is produced by William Welch and directed by Fred Way.
There's quite a bit of material from William Ten that's in the public domain. So if you like this, you might want to check the show notes. www.nighttransmissions, one word, no space between the night and the transmissions.com. I'll do that one more time, www.nighttransmissions.com. Click on the Shows button, and from the index there, choose Show 65. Scroll to the bottom of the show notes, and you will find some links for more of William Ten.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Jerry Dixon. The Dead Mother by Unknown. In a certain village there lived a husband and wife, lived happily, lovingly, peaceably. All their neighbors envied them. The sight of them gave pleasure to honest folks. Well, the mistress bore a son, but directly after it was born, she died. The poor mujik moaned and wept. Above all, he was in despair about the babe. How was he to nourish it now? How to bring it up without its mother? He did what was best and hired an old woman to look after it. Only here was a wonder. All day long, the babe would take no food and did nothing but cry. There was no soothing it anyhow. But during a great part of the night, one could fancy it wasn't there at all, so silently and peacefully did it sleep. "What's the meaning of this?" thinks the old woman. "Suppose I keep awake tonight. Maybe I shall find out." Well, just at midnight, she heard someone quietly open the door and go up to the cradle. The babe became still, just as if it was being suckled. The next night, the same thing took place, and the third night, too. Then she told the mujik about it. He called his kinsfolk together and held counsel with them. They determined on this, to keep awake on a certain night and to spy out who it was that came to suckle the babe. So at eventide they all lay down on the floor, and beside them they set a lighted taper hidden in an earthen pot. At midnight the cottage door opened. Someone stepped up to the cradle. The babe became still. At that moment one of the kinsfolk suddenly brought out the light. They looked and saw the dead mother in the very same clothes in which she had been buried, on her knees beside the cradle, over which she bent as she suckled the babe at her dead breast. The moment the light shone in the cottage, she stood up, gazed sadly on her little one, and then went out of the room without a sound, not saying a word to anyone. All those who saw her stood for a time terror-struck, and then they found the babe was dead. End of The Dead Mother by Unknown. Recorded by Jerry Dixon, Zephyr Hills, Florida.
Truth is stranger than fiction. And this is the proof. This is Ridley's. Believe it or not.
Duncan MacIntyre, the greatest poet of the Scottish Highlands, whose literary magnitude has been compared to Robert Burns, could neither read nor write. Believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about a strange 14th century vigil.
Oh, okay. We're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon.
A bed has been kept ready for the arrival of a guest for more than 1,400 years. A monk named Pao Chi died in the year 514 in the memorial temple of Hangzhou, China. His last words were, "I shall return." Apparently, Pao Chi's fellow monks took him at his word because they've changed the linen on Pao Chi's bed more than 57 million times over the last 14 centuries. Believe it or not.
This final story tonight is a little different in that the author, Elliot O'Donnell, would deny that it is fiction. Elliot O'Donnell was born on February the 27th of 1872 and died on May the 8th of 1965. And was an English author who's today, if he's known at all, is known primarily for his books about ghosts. He claimed to have seen a ghost when he was 5 years old, which he described as an elemental figure covered with spots, and also claimed to have the experience of being strangled by a phantom in Dublin. In later life, he became an actual ghost hunter. He traveled in America, working on a range in Oregon, and then became a policeman during the Chicago railway strike. Then, back in England, he worked as a schoolmaster and trained for the theater. He served in the British Army in World War II and later acted on the stage in movies. I'll have to see if I can find a film clip or something to link to in the show notes. Not promising anything. I haven't looked yet. Eventually, he became known as an authority on the supernatural and was in some fair demand as a ghost hunter. He went around the country, the world really, lecturing, was a frequent guest on broadcast radio and television, where he was presented as an expert on the paranormal in Britain and the United States. Finally, by the end of his life, he had written more than 60 books and scores of articles, both here in the United States and in Britain. This particular story, The Headless Cat of Number Blank Lower Seedley Road, Seedley, Manchester, is from his book, Animal Ghost, which was published in 1913 and is read by Bologna Times.
The Headless Cat of Number Blank, Lower Seedley Road, by Elliot O'Donnell. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Bologna Times. The Headless Cat of Number Blank, Lower Seedley Road, by Elliot O'Donnell. It was related to me by Mr. Robert Dane, who was at one time a tenant of Number Blank, Lower Seedley Road, Seedley. I quote it as nearly as possible in his words, thus: "When we, my wife and I, took Number Blank, Lower Seedley Road, No possibility of the place being haunted crossed our minds. Indeed, ghosts were the very last, as neither of us had the slightest belief in them. Like the generality of solicitors, I am stodgy and unimaginative, whilst my wife is the most practical and matter-of-fact little woman you would meet in a day's march. Nor was there anything about the house that in any way suggested the superphysical. It was airy and light, no dark corners nor sinister staircases, and equipped throughout with all modern conveniences. We began our lease in June, the hottest June I remember, and nothing occurred to disturb us till October. It happened then in this wise. I will quote from my diary. Monday, October 11th. Dick, that is my brother-in-law, and I, at 11 p.m., were sitting, smoking, and chatting together in the study. All the rest of the household had gone to bed. We had no light in the room, as Dick had a headache, save the fire, and that burned so low that its feeble glimmering scarcely enabled us to see each other's face. After a space of sudden and thoughtful silence, Dick took the stump of a cigar from his lips and threw it into the grate, where, for a few minutes, it lay glowing in the gloom. "Jack," he said, "you will think me mad, but there is something deuced queer about this room tonight, something in the atmosphere I cannot define, but which I have never felt here, or indeed anywhere, before. Look at that cigar end. Look!" I did so, and received a shock. What I saw was certainly not the stump Dick had had in his mouth, but an eye, a large, red and lurid eye that looked up at us with an expression of the utmost hate. Dick raised the shovel and struck at it, but without effect. It still glared at us. A great horror then seized us, and unable to remove our gaze from the hellish thing, we sat glued to our chairs staring at it. This state of affairs lasted till the clock in the hall outside struck 12, when the eyes suddenly vanished, and we both felt as if some intensely evil influence had been suddenly removed. Dick did not like the idea of sleeping alone, and asked if he might keep the electric light on in his room all night. Tremendous extravagance, but under the circumstances, excusable. I confess devoutly, wished it was morning. Tuesday, October 12th. I was awakened at 11:30 p.m. by Delia saying to me, "Oh, Edward, there have been such dreadful noises on the landing, just as if a cat were being worried to death by dogs. Hark, there it is again." And as she spoke, from apparently just outside the door, came a series of loud screeches, accompanied by savage growls and snarls. Not knowing what to make of it, as we had no animals of our own in the house, but concluding that a door or a window having been left open, a dog and cat had got in from outside, I lit a candle and opened the bedroom door. Instantly the sound ceased, and there was dead silence, and although I searched everywhere, not a vestige of any animal was to be seen. Moreover, all the doors leading into the garden were shut and locked, and the windows closed. Not wishing to frighten Delia, I laughingly assured her the cat, a black tom, was all right, that it was sitting on the roof of the summer house, looking none the worse for its treatment, and that I had sent the dog, a terrier, flying out the gate with a well-deserved kick. I explained it was my fault about the front door being left open. My brain had been a bit overstrained through excessive work, and asked her on no account to blame the servants. I grow alarmed at times when I realize how easy lawyering makes lying. Friday, October 21st. On my way to bed last night, I encountered a rush of icy cold air at the first bend of the staircase. The candle flared up, a bright blue flame, and went out. Something, an animal of sorts, came tearing down the stairs past me, and on peering over the banisters I saw, looking up from me from the well of darkness beneath, two big red eyes, the counterparts of the one Dick and I had seen in October 11th. I threw a matchbox at them, but without effect. It was only when I switched on the electric light that they had disappeared. I searched the house most carefully, but there were no signs of any animal. Joined Delia, feeling nervous and henpecky. Monday, November 7th. Tom and Mabel came running into Delia's room in a great state of excitement after tea today. "Mother," they cried, "Mother, do come. Some horrid dog has got a cat in the spare room and is tearing it to pieces." Delia, who was mending my socks at the time, flung them everywhere, and springing to her feet, flew to the spare room. The door was shut, but proceeding from within was the most appalling pandemonium of screeches and snarls, just as if some dog had got hold of a cat by the neck and was shaking it to death. Delia swung open the door and rushed in. The room was empty, not a trace of a cat or dog anywhere, and the sound ceased. On my return home, Delia met me in the garden. "Jack," she said, "I have probed the mystery at last. The house is haunted. We must leave." Saturday, November 12th. Sublet house to James Barstow, retired oil merchant, today. He comes in on the 30th. Hope he'll like it. Tuesday, November 15th. Cook left today. "I've no fault to find with you, Mum," she condescendingly explained to Delia. "It's not you, nor the children, nor the food. It's the noises at night. Screeches outside my door, which sound like a cat, but which I know can't be a cat, as there is no cat in the house. This morning, Mum, shortly after the clock struck two, things came to a climax. Hearing something in the corner, and wondering if it was a mouse, I ain't a bit afraid of mice, Mum, I sat up in bed and was getting ready to strike a light. The matchbox was in my hand, when something heavy sprang right on top of me and gave a loud growl in my ear. That finished me, Mum. I fainted. When I came to myself, I was too frightened to stir, but lay with my head under the blankets till it was time to get up. I then searched everywhere, but there was no sign of any dog, and as the door was locked, there was no possibility of any dog having got in during the night. Mum, I wouldn't go through what I suffered again for £50. I've got palpitations even now, and I would rather go without my month's wages than sleep in that room another night." Delia paid her up to date, and she went directly after tea. Friday, November 18th. As I was coming out of the bathroom at 11 p.m., something fell into the bath with a loud splash. I turned to see what it was. There was nothing there. I ran up the stairs to bed, three steps at a time. Sunday, November 20th. Went to church in the morning and heard the usual Oxford drawl. On the way back, I was pondering over the sermon and wishing I could contort the law as successfully as parsons contort the scriptures when Dot, she is six today, came running up to me with a very scared expression in her eyes. "Father," she cried, plucking me by the sleeve, "do hurry up. Mother is very ill." Full of dreadful anticipations, I tore home, and on arriving found Delia lying on the sofa in a violent fit of hysterics. It was fully an hour before she recovered sufficiently to tell me what had happened. Her account runs thus. "After you went to church," she began. "I made the custard pudding, jelly, and blancmange for dinner. Heard the children their collects, and had just sat down with the intention of writing a letter to mother, when I heard a very pathetic mew coming, so I thought, from under the sofa. Thinking it was some stray cat that had gotten in through one of the windows, I tried to entice it out by calling, 'Puss, Puss,' and making the usual silly noise people do on such occasions. No cat coming out, and the mewing still continuing, I knelt down and peered under the sofa. There was no cat there. Had it been night, I should have been very much afraid, but I could scarcely reconcile myself to the idea of ghost with the room filled with sunshine. Resuming my seat, I went on with my writing, but not for long. The mewing grew nearer. I distinctly heard something crawl out from under the sofa. There was then a pause, during which you could have heard the proverbial pen fall, and then something sprang upon me and dug its claws in my knees. I looked down, and to my horror and distress, perceived, standing on its hind legs, pawing at my clothes, a large tabby cat without a head, the neck terminating in a mangled stump. The sight so appalled me that I don't know what happened, but nurse and the children came in and found me lying on the floor in hysterics. Can't we leave the house at once? Wednesday, November 30th. Left, number blank, Lower Seedley Road, at 2 p.m. Had an awful scurry to get things packed in time, and dread opening certain of the packing cases, lest we shall find all the crockery smashed. Just as we were starting, Delia cried out that she had left her reticule behind, and I was dispatched in search of it. I searched everywhere, till I was worn out, for I know what Delia is, and was leaving the premises in full anticipation of being sent back again, when there was a loud commotion in the hall, just as if a dog had suddenly pounced upon a cat, and the next moment a large tabby, with a head hewn away as Delia had described, rushed up to me and tried to spring onto my shoulders. At this juncture, one of the servants cautiously opened the hall door from without and informed me that I was wanted. The cat instantly vanished, and, on my reaching the carriage in a state of breathless haste and trepidation, Delia told me she had found her reticule. She had been sitting on it all the time. In a subsequent note in his diary, a year or so later, Mr. Dane says, "After innumerable inquiries re the history of number blank, Lower Seedley Road, prior to our inhabiting it, I have at length elicited the fact that 12 years ago a Mr. and Mrs. Barlow lived there. They had one son, Arthur, whom they spoilt in a most outrageous fashion, even to the extent of encouraging him in acts of cruelty. To afford him amusement, they used to buy rats for his dog, a fox terrier, to worry, and on one occasion procured a stray cat, which the servants afterwards declared was mangled in the most shocking manner, before being finally destroyed by Arthur. Here, then, in my opinion, is a very feasible explanation for the hauntings. The phenomenon seen was the phantasm of the poor, tortured cat. For if human tragedies are reenacted by ghosts, why not animal tragedies, too? It is absurd to suppose man has the monopoly of soul or spirit." End of The Headless Cat of Number Blank, Lower Seedley Road.
Smoke and your prayers like rhymes, and your silver cross, and your voice like chimes. Who do they think could bear you with your pockets wet? Which you place on the grass, and your flesh like silk, and your face like glass. Who could they get to ever carry you? Sad-eyed lady of the low.
And your mom. destroy you. Sad-eyed lady of the lowlands, with a sad eye.